and you get one. It's Sunday night, and it's time for the TechNet. Sunday night in New York. And TechNet Live is what you're going to be hearing. This is where people come to get many of their questions answered over the last 30 years by their fellow amateurs, discussing, passing on the knowledge of what they've learned as to how all this equipment works and how to make it work better. That's what the TechNet basically does. For 30 years, starting back in late 1982, this group has been gathering at this time, at this place, to try to tap into that brain power. There's an awful lot of brain power in the tri-state area of New York. From time to time, you're going to be hearing signals that shouldn't be there. When you do, please go to the reverse mode on your particular rig, listen to 146.25, the input frequency, and tell us whatever you hear, how strong it is, what direction it came from. Tell us where you are, particularly if you're mobile. Tell us where you were. We're getting quite a few of those reports, and they're quite helpful. And you're going to report that information to RFI@Limark.org. RFI stands for Radio Frequency Interference. So RFI@Limark.org is where you're going to report that. And those reports will be very helpful. There's a disgruntled person who has been creating some disruption, and somebody's going to have to eventually convince him that's not quite socially acceptable. The TechNet, let me drop. The TechNet over the years has slowly evolved into a particular recipe. The recipe may not please everybody, but if you've got a better recipe, please suggest it to us. The recipe is that we do certain things at certain times. So the first hour or so, we answer general questions. That's followed by John, KC2WGEB, giving us the mailbag. For those who don't yet have their amateur license or don't have the right equipment to be able to talk live to this particular group, they're able to submit their questions. And John selects a few of those each week that have a general interest. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, a space expert, who tells us what the latest that the National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. And those three things are quite popular. That's followed by the time that's left over, we get into deeper subjects because there's a certain section of the amateur radio group. Let me drop. A certain section of the amateur radio group that have curiosity about many things, whether it be science, technology, astronomy, medicine, repairing oil burners, whatever. Amateurs are very curious people, and that's extremely good because there's lots of evidence that the way mankind makes progress is to display curiosity in any old subject. And there are people who think, hey, I don't want this brand new smarts on some subject I didn't request. I don't want the brand new useless knowledge. What in the world is that? How can new knowledge be useless? Somehow, the people who say things like that, apparently they haven't listened to their parents telling them that education is always useful. Don't turn down an application, an opportunity to get some more education. Okay, so the further details of our menu, let me drop. The further detail of our menu is that we take sign-ins of people who do have a question or a comment for the net. You're going to sign in by giving me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Typical sign-in would be N2EO, Rich and Yes, a man who has signed in many times over the years. The you're not going to. There's two other things you're not going to hear. We're not going to hear, is there any emergency traffic? Everybody who runs a net for traditional reasons thinks they've got to say those words. They almost never get an answer. I don't quite understand that one. Alrighty. Give me your call letters and name right now. And as I said, you don't have to sign in. Please don't sign in if you don't have a question or a comment. Give me your call letters and name. K2RIW listening.
N2EO, Rich with a question. N2EO, Rich, yes.
Who was that masked man? Who was that unknown guy? Okay, Rich, you're certainly recognized. Give me the next guy you want to sign in. Give me your call letters and name right now.
Good evening, Victor. N2YYL, November 2, Yankee Lima. Yes, with a question.
Okay, and I think you're on Echo Link or IRLP. Mr. Yankee Lima, part of the recipe is you're supposed to give me your call letters, the yes, and your name. So please give
got that, Dick. Yeah, the name here is Mike. Yes, I'm on Echo Link also.
Very fine, Mike. You sound good on Echo Link. And for each of us, when I pass it back to you, even though you might be kind of excited that you're going to be on this great big show called the TechNet, make sure you wait for the beeps so the machine gets reset so that the people in the outer areas by way of Echo Link or IRLP don't get cut out of the equation, if you know what I mean. Alrighty? Who's the next person we'd like to sign? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
Number 2, Z Echo Alpha. My name is Glenn.
And Paul with the Space Report. Good evening, everybody.
DPZ, now, with quickie answers.
Yeah, I goofed on that one. I forgot to mention how K6DPZ will give us the more brief answers. And if you listen to, if you've gone to YouTube video and you've dialed in those call letters and or the Ham Radio University, you'll see a very nice display that Hal presented that's recorded, and you can play it back. And Hal came along and brought us a whole lot of pieces of equipment that were kind of interesting. We got Paul, Joe, and Glenn in reverse order. Glenn, Joe, and Paul got all you guys. And I'm sure I heard N2Z Echo Alpha for Glenn. I'm pretty sure I got that right. And if not, please correct me. If not, no problem. Anyone else assigning? Give me your call letters and name right now. We have more than enough to get going. So, Rich. Rich with his brand new microphone. How are things going with you tonight, Rich? And two, Echo Alpha. Here we go. Echo Oscar. The radio voice of Massapequa Park, K2RAW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. How are we getting in, first of all?
You sound beautiful. I can even hear other voices in the background. Go right ahead. And don't worry about that.
Okay, Dick, very good. N2EO. Yeah, I have a maybe it's an unusual question, but I'm concerned about operation on HF, VHF, and UHF from a mobile home, a double-wide mobile home, which would be approximately 24 feet wide and about 35 feet long. The reason I'm bringing this up, Dick, it's doubtful that I'll be able to keep the house here in Massapequa Park. The cost just outweigh the income, and I'm going to reset. I'm looking at going into a mobile home park. One, there's a couple out by MacArthur Airport. There's one on Route 110. There's one in Amityville. And a whole host of them that I uncovered on the internet. But I'm wondering, there is a fellow I ran into, haven't been able to touch base with him, Frank, I'm wondering if there's anybody else who's successfully operated from a mobile home in a mobile home park, and I'm going to reset. Okay, Dick. And also, would I be correct in assuming a quarter wave vertical on 40 through 10 mounted on the side of a mobile home, that the mobile home would work as a good counterpoise, because they're basically all metal. So these are my questions, especially if there's anybody on frequency who currently is or has successfully operated from a mobile home. I do not want to go into an apartment. I've been a ham since I'm 15 years old. I'm now 63. Been playing with radio since I'm 11. Back to net, N2EO.
Okay, I'll take things in sort of reverse order, Rich. The good news about a mobile home is it tends to be a very large chunk of metal by comparison to an automobile. As such, automatically, as an antenna maven, maybe it's not the right word, as a person who's got to, claims a, quite a bit of experience with antennas, I can tell you that the amount of counterpoise on 40 through 10 meters you're going to get out of a mobile home is going to be pretty good. So if the antenna itself is working properly, I think you're going to have very little trouble with the antenna giving you the right visual, the right gain, and whatever. Now, whether or not your mobile home is on high enough land and whether or not it's crowded by a whole lot of buildings around, there are other factors that may affect your ham radio operation. And some of the things that your eye sees are relatively transparent. A tree on 40 meters, for instance, I think is reasonably transparent. On 10 gigs, it's one hell of a blockage. So things are very frequency sensitive along those lines. I'm going to pass it over in a few minutes to either Hal, who probably knows people who have got mobile home experience, or others who have actually done it and give us their words on it. As I said, in a couple of minutes, I'm going to do that. Let me drop. I do know one other thing, Rich. I wish there was some kind of a way that you could try it for a while without really committing to it. You had a certain amount of volume to live in your Whitestone house. You've had a certain amount of volume to live in your Massapequa Park house. Guarantee you're going to be living on a lot less space inside of a mobile home. You're going to be a little bit more crowded. If you can adapt, and I mean, one of the definitions of intelligence is the ability to adapt to a new environment. If you can adapt to a very compact lifestyle, then maybe it will work for you. But many of the ham radio operators, certainly I, are pack rats. I am a pack rat, and many of the serious ham radio operators, they tend to collect a lot of antique radios. You did that. A lot of spare parts for other projects. I've got a cellar that's full. I've got a ham room that's full. I've got a garage that's full. There are times when my car is full of equipment. So that's going to be cramped quite a bit in a mobile home. Another thing to consider, although it may be extreme, there was a period of time when the state of New York declared mobile homes as the following: substandard housing for second-class citizens. Why they did that, I don't know. But there was a brief period of time when that was an official declaration in some of the literature from New York State. Guarantee somebody complained real fast and that got corrected. But it gives you a little bit of hint of the way some people have an attitude about it. Now, if you guys listening to me know of anyone with a mobile home and a ham radio operator, and whether the information is favorable or unfavorable, or we call a spade here, please give me a call at us right now. And right after anybody does or doesn't respond to that, I'm going to pass it over to Hal and see what he's going to say. So first, anyone with experience, give me a call at us right now, K2RIW and SecNet. Okay, Hal, you've talked to lots of people, and you've put lots of equipment in compact spaces. I can tell by going to the pictures you've displayed from time to time. So I wonder if you've got an opinion about how happy do you think Rich, I mean, you and I have known Rich for a lot of years. Do you have a guess as to how happy do you think Rich will be? I'm going to also pass it over to John for that subject, but Hal first. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the SecNet.
RIW in SecNet, K6DPZ. Okay, from what I understand, Rich is not talking just about a simple mobile home. He's talking about attached double trailer, which is a lot more surface area, number one. And that would give a certain amount of space for him if he wants to still keep other things, not just a single trailer. As far as a mobile home goes, if it's aluminum siding and everything else, I don't see any reason why it won't work. It'd be a good counterpoise. I would also make sure to ground the counterpoise to a good earth ground. And I've known people out in California, Palm Desert and other places of camps that worked out of mobile homes that are very successful. So it's a positive situation. Sure, he's limited to the type of antenna. You'd have to go omnidirectional vertical. It'd be hard to put a beam up. But I'm sure it would work out very satisfactorily. That's my comment, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a reasonably positive report from hearing from you, Hal. Glad to hear that. Some of those California guys with those mobile homes, my experience, how many guys happen to end up in a valley somewhere, and are they still happy is an interesting question. John, you've known Rich for a lot of years. You know pretty much where he stands with his ham radio operation. Do you have a guess as to whether or not he'll be happy with a mobile home? I am also curious, how are mobile homes accepted in Richmond County, Staten Island, where you live? Are there a good number of them? Are the people happy with them? And so on. KC2, here we go. KC2WBG, KQRIW. Go ahead, John.
Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. No, we don't have any trailer parks or anything here. There was one near the Gold Hills Bridge for a while. I think it's finally been abandoned because the tax base is just too high to be able to support that kind of occupancy. But I do know people upstate who are working on double wides and in some case triple wide, actually put on their ranch property, and they do HF, not too much 2 meters, but they're very successful, and that ground plane that Hal was describing worked very well for them. And, you know, plus they drove a few ground rods. They didn't even have much of a tower. I think it was maybe, it wasn't fixed to the trailer exactly, but it was over it by a little cantilever on the tower. The tower was maybe 12 feet, 13 feet, and they're doing extremely well. Now, right now, Rich is living basically in sort of one room, so I think the confinement is really not an issue, especially in a double wide. That's a lot of square footage, and a lot of modern appliances can be put in them. You can buy used ones, very reasonable, already set up, so maybe an idea for him, but he'd have to discuss that with his cousin and the people who are managing his funds. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Okay, let me thank Hal and John for those comments. So it sounds to me like if you're willing to adapt, sounds like you can do it. And yes, the mobile homes tend to be a lot less expensive. I presume the taxes on those tend to be a lot expensive. However, you still have problems of the connection you got to make, no matter where you're stationed with your mobile home. It's going to require all kinds of hookups for fluids to flow in and fluids to flow out, if you know what I mean. Electricity that flows in and the space itself. And is the real cost of location. I mean, in an ordinary home, we're paying property tax, and you're paying the equivalent of that plus a space tax, so to speak, in the trailer park. Does it come out that much more economically advantageous? You'll soon find that all out. So back to you for any final comments on this, Rich, and good luck with that project. And to Yankee Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet. Sorry about that. And to Echo Oscar, I'll get it right. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. And to Echo Oscar, very good, Dick. The double wide, see, a single wide is 12 feet wide, 35 feet long. A double wide is also 30 long, but 24 feet wide. That's what I would get, what I was advised by somebody in Florida also today. These parks generally get about $900 a month is a carrying charge, which covers everything. There's no tax that covers that. They're paying the property tax, and you're paying it on the carrying charge. And these mobile homes range anywhere from $59,000 to $150,000. So there you have it, Dick. Let me turn it back to you. Hold on.
Okay, Rich, we're going to go to the next person. And good luck with that project. Mike, and to Yankee Lima. Man, and... Cortland Manor, New York, 43 miles from me, airline distance, according to QRZ.com. Back to you, Mike, and what would you like to talk about tonight? We'll discuss anything but antennas. I'm having some fun with you. And to YYL, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody. My question has to do almost with antennas, but I'm curious as to more or less like a repeater site that has a duplexer, and they have like cavities, and I was wondering how they actually operate. I know that it's like a tube that's about like 2 or 3 feet high, and it's got a strap of wire inside for the input, and another strap for the output, and has like a middle. I'm just wondering how radio waves actually, you know, propagate or do whatever they have to do in there to make them properly work, to make the signal certain frequencies go through and block other frequencies. Over to back to you, Dick.
A quickie or a long answer?
Hal's going to give you a quick answer. I'm going to give you quite a bit more answer because of what's going on between me and John. We suddenly got curiosity on that subject and we decided to start studying it. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Hal.
K2RIW, in section of K6DPZ. Okay, well, basically, you're talking about high-Q cavities. And the way the cavities are set up, we call it pass and reject. One set of cavities will pass through, let's say, the receive frequency while rejecting the transmitter frequency. The other set of cavities will pass through the transmitter frequency, rejecting the receive frequency. And it's basically a pass and a notch. There are many different configurations of doing this. When you're closer in frequency, you should have more cavities on each side. Sadly, most duplexers on VHF, they use between 3 and 4 cavities. The size of cavities, the UHF duplexers are not that big. A 6-meter duplexer can stand 5 feet tall. There's also another type of duplexer configuration that's called a hybrid ring. And that's a little more complex, which I'll let Dick go into the hybrid ring type of duplexer. Duplexers are not that hard to tune with proper equipment. Generally, you use a tracking generator, station monitor, or a sweep generator, and a signal generator, and a spectrum analyzer. So that's my quickie answer, and go ahead, Dick, pick it up. K2RIW, K6DPC.
Thank you, Hal. What's really going on here, Mike, is filtering. We amateur operators would love to have lots of good filtering on our transmitters so that the signals come out on one frequency only and the harmonics and other things are suppressed. Our receiver, we'd like to receive one frequency at a time, particularly if you're living in a place like New York City, which is really rich with radio transmitters. If you don't have proper filtering somewhere and other signals that are strong get into your receiver, you're going to have grief. So how sharp can a filter be made without having a whole lot of insertion loss? That property is called Q. The method by which you build a filter makes a big difference. You start studying filters and you realize you pick up an inductor and a capacitor, you put one across the other, you've got a resonant circuit. Choose the right size inductor and the right size capacitor. You put it on the table and you do some testing, you'll find out. You can easily tune it to 146 megacycles, this particular ham band, and you could use that as a filter in the front end of your receiver. You do a little bit of study and you'll find that filter is going to be, let me pick a number, 20 megahertz wide. And you'd like it to be 100 kilohertz wide or less. As such, you need a much sharper filter. How do you make a sharper filter? You can do it sometimes by putting a whole lot of filters together, cascaded, but that's not always the best way. If the individual filter is made with higher and higher Q, what is Q? Q is a function of how much loss the signal experiences when it goes through that resonating circuit. If you stop using a inductor and a capacitor, and you use, let me drop it. You use what the microwave mavens call a distributed network. You take a cross-section. If you could cut a saw right through the middle of one of those cavity filters that's used as a duplexing filter on a repeater, you cut a saw through it, and it looks like an extremely large piece of coaxial cable, very similar to inch and 5/8 Andrew Heliac, so to speak. You got a center conductor that's very close to a quarter wavelength long. You got the outer conductor of the coax. And the reason why you make it that large in diameter is because just like Andrew Infant 5/8 Heliac, the larger diameter cable with air-filled dielectric has a hell of a lot less loss than, say, a piece of RG8U. So you make it larger in diameter and you use the right materials, you get less loss. Therefore, the signal that must bounce back and forth and stay in resonance inside of that filter in order for the filtering function to take place, if on each pass the signal has essentially no loss, then by the laws of physics, the Q will be high, the bandwidth will be narrow, you'll be able to tune the filter to the individual frequencies you want. One set of filters is going to be tuned to the transmitter, like Hal said, two or three filters. Two or three more filters are tuned to the receiver. That whole network goes to a T connector into the single antenna, and you've got a repeater when you set it up right. There is a way of adding an extra gimmick capacitor on the receivers and a gimmick inductor on the transmitter filters so you get an additional notch 600 kCOA in the case of a 2-meter repeater. But that's a minor detail. The main function of that cavity filter is to have extremely low loss as a transmission line. Set it up so it's a quarter wavelength long with the right kind of input and output coupling network, and you've got the world's best filter that you'll ever get your hands on, with the exception of a quartz crystal. And quartz crystals don't go that high. Quartz crystal can have a Q of a million. A well-made cavity filter can have a Q of 5,000. That inductor and capacitor you put on the table would have trouble having a Q of 50. The higher the number for the Q, the sharper the filtering, the less the insertion loss. There's a hell of a lot more to the story, Mike, but if you go to chapter 18, I think it is, or is it chapter 14, one or the other, of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, the section that's called repeaters, you go to that section of your Radio Amateur's Handbook, and you start reading, and you're going to say, wow, there's a whole art and science there. Good stuff. That's the beginning of the story, Mike. N2 Yankee Yankee Lemur. You're allowed to ask the question more in the future if you want to. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Mike. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that. Yeah, I've been reading some stuff on this, and you explained it more better than what I've been reading. So I'll be doing a lot more studying on this. I'm just like fascinated on how it operates, like how radio waves bounce inside the actual cans themselves, and get, I don't know, where certain radio waves get grounded and others pass through. I was just curious as to how to operate. But thanks for the answer, and have a good night.
Yeah, to say that the signal gets grounded, that comes close. The fact that the energy you put into a filter, just like the energy you put into a dipole antenna, that energy must bounce back and forth some number of times. In the case of your dipole, it bounces back and forth 20 times. In the case of that cavity filter with a Q of 5,000 that you're using for a duplexing requirement, the signal bounces back and forth on there 5,000 times before it becomes dissipated. I'm rounding off the numbers a little bit. But the idea that the energy is, it's like a flywheel, the energy bounces back and forth, none of the books explain it from that point of view. For me, it helps. Maybe that point of view will help for you also. Studying how filters work is a very worthwhile thing, as I see it, Mike, because we electronic engineers, anybody involved with wireless hardware, transmitters, receivers, and antennas, you're going to be using filters for the rest of your life. And the way filters are taught in the colleges could definitely be done a lot better. The way it's taught in the books could definitely be a lot better, in my opinion. And many of the sources you'll read make it sound like it's rocket science. It's not. You talk to a guy who's done a little bit of tinkering with a grid tip oscillator, an inexpensive tuning device on his bench with a simple inductor and capacitor. You'll learn an awful lot of filtering right away. And the one other thing to know, let me drop, is that the magic of a filter is that when you set it up correctly, at the frequency you want to pass, you'll see a 50-ohm input impedance, a 50-ohm output impedance, the signal will flow through the filter, and the signal at that frequency will have very little loss. That's the so-called pass band. You tune very far away to where the filter is giving you a rejection. You say, how is it doing that? You'd like to believe the signal just simply gets grounded. Good explanation, overly simplified. You go one step further and you study with a network analyzer. What is the filter doing on the frequencies that don't get passed through? The filter acts like a short circuit at that frequency. At the frequencies that are rejected, it acts like a short circuit. Therefore, all the signal that you send into the filter acts like it's got a 99.9% of the signal gets reflected from the filter back toward the source. The books don't tell you that. Therefore, you set up a filter on the output of a mixer, and you test the mixer under laboratory conditions. It works like a charm. You put it in your receiver where it's looking into a filter, and you get a different response, and you wonder why. And the answer is the filter might not like looking into a short circuit at some of those other frequencies. So know that the short circuit of the filter characteristic, very high standing wave ratio on the reject frequencies, is sort of built in unless you go to the next step, using a circulator to correct that condition, or there's a whole class of very secret filters that are called constant impedance filters. I'm not going to explain that. Just remember those words, constant impedance filter. Very rare. Not many of the radio guys know about it. And if you enter that world, boy, you can do some even further magic. So make your investment in learning filters. That knowledge will never fail you. It's something you're going to want to know if you're going to be in radio, in my opinion, Mike. Next person who signed in was Glenn. November.
Comment on that, Dick.
Hold on. We got some more information. John, by the way, I mentioned earlier that John and I recently have developed a hell of a lot of curiosity about how filters really behave. So we're starting to tinker with them. KC2WGB, he does a lot more than tinker. K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Tinker Square. All right. I just wanted to let you know, at those emails that you sent me with some of those YouTube articles, excellent resource, and I found a few others. Just go on YouTube, Google that cavity filter, and it'll show you all different types with a pretty good explanation, and he can get some very good basics there. That was a quick comment. Back to you, Dick.
And maybe what we should do for Mike and everyone else who's listening, John and I have been collecting articles, YouTube videos, explanations, books, whatever, on the subject of cavity filters. And maybe we should take what we've gathered and put it into the Dropbox, the K2 Yankee Oscar Dropbox. And so sometime in the future we'll tell you when you can go there, go to the Dropbox, and pick up that information. Therefore, a couple of hours of research that we've done, selecting good sources where they show nice pictures, cross-sections, and explanations, it'll give you a leg up when it comes to learning the information in a hurry. Because that's what we amateurs are good at, helping each other to educate each other on the subjects that we consider of interest and are useful. Glenn was the next guy, N2, Zebra Echo Alpha. Go right ahead, Glenn. K2RIW in the tech net.
Thank you, Dick. I was at Ham University a couple weeks back, and they were talking about bunny hunting, and they had a loop antenna for 2 meters. And look at it, and it's just a simple loop. And I was wondering, how does that something that's got a zero impedance for DC, how does that not give the finals a problem?
Hal, you got a quick explanation on that? I've got a quick explanation. Well, nothing I do is quick. K6DPZ, K2RIZ, be good, Hal.
Well, is he talking about a loop being used for transmitting? Or, no, he didn't say enough. He just says, what happens with finals? Tell me a little more what you're trying to get at. I'm just listening here. I just didn't get the full point.
If he wants to use a loop as a direction-finding antenna, and how does the loop give you the right impedance at the right frequency when it looks like it's a short circuit? And how in the world do you take that loop and make it into a fox-hunting antenna? He was attending Heim Radio University on the section on fox hunting. Over to you, Hal.
Matthew Mullen answers questions.
First of all, I don't know if he's just talking about a circular loop and you feed it at the base, or if he's talking about a coaxial loop. There are two different types of loops, and you can match the impedance of the loop. So I have to have more before I can give an honest answer here.
Yeah, as I see it, Glenn, the most basic kind of an antenna is a dipole. You can take a dipole and curve it around on itself so that it becomes a circle. Lots of people think that a loop antenna and a dipole antenna are absolutely different antennas. They have a strong similarity, electronically speaking. Yes, you make the loop approximately one wavelength in diameter, so you could say it's got a U-shaped dipole for the lower half of the loop and an upside-down U for the upper half of the loop. That's why the pair of half-wave dipoles make a full wavelength circumference. Almost any piece of wire with any shape in the world, whether it be a circle, a dipole, a crisscross for a turnstile antenna, no matter how you set up a piece of wire, if you're smart enough, there are ways you can force it into resonance with something like an antenna tuner. Once you put energy into that antenna and you force it into resonance, it will radiate. So the real magic of an antenna is you resonate first, then it will radiate. Once the antenna will radiate as a transmitter and give you a pretty good impedance match, then as a receiver, because of the law of reciprocity, however it behaves on transmit, it will behave equally well on receive. Now, when you take that loop antenna, which ordinarily radiates a pattern very similar to a dipole, you look at the pattern coming out of a dipole, you look at the pattern coming out of a horizontally polarized loop, they're essentially identical. If you add one other rod to that loop, instead of it being a bi-directional thing, let me drop. Instead of it being bi-directional, when you add one extra rod and properly fix it, you can make the bi-directional loop characteristic become unidirectional. It gives you a cardioid pattern, a heart-shaped pattern. And that's the one that people usually use for bunny hunting. So once you've got that loop antenna acting like this cardioid pattern, this heart-shaped pattern, where it's it gives you a peak in one direction, a null in the other, you can now rotate that as you're driving around and do bunny hunting. Some of the early FCC direction finding use loop antennas. So a loop antenna, as I said, it's not that much magic than a dipole, but as a bunny hunting antenna, it's got some very nice characteristics. That's part of the story, Glenn. N2ZEA, KQLAW in the TechNet.
Tell about the Babcock antenna, that's a directional type antenna.
My question is, if it's got a zero DC impedance, does it have to be capacitively coupled to the transmitter? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, I know where you're going on that one. Let me get the beep here. Stand by. It turns out that there's a whole lot of antenna-like structures. If I take, for instance, a piece of coax cable that's going into a 50-ohm dummy load, and I put an RF choke right across the dummy load, semiconductor to shield, on the transmission line. With your ohm meter, you will measure 0 ohms. At radio frequencies, that choke that I just described has got a very high inductive impedance. At radio frequencies, the choke becomes an open circuit. That loop antenna, even though with your ohm meter, it's got 0 ohms, at radio frequencies, that 0 ohm disappears because of the inductance, you could say, or the reactance, or the resonance. So there's lots and lots of antennas. For instance, many of the station master antennas, you put the thing that's used for repeater type service, a vertical collinear station master brand name antenna. You put your ohm meter across that, you'll measure 0 ohms. You put 146 megacycles in there, and you'll measure 50 ohms. So you don't have to have capacitive coupling to receive this characteristic, as I see it, Glenn. There's lots and lots of circuits and antennas that are at DC, at very low frequencies, your ohm meter will show 0 ohms. At radio frequencies, they can be 50 ohms, they can be an open circuit. That's some of the magic of radio, if you know what I mean. So don't be confused by the ohm meter measurement. That's just one of the characteristics at a frequency that you don't transmit on, if you know what I mean, Glenn. N2ZEA, wait for the beeps, KQLAW in the TechNet.
So you say it's kind of like the primary of a transformer. A DC, it's a short, but as soon as it's AC, it's got inductance and therefore impedance.
Give that man a cigar. You've got the concept, Glenn. That's exactly it. An extremely well-made transformer will be 0 ohms with your ohm meter, and it can be essentially an open circuit when you put 120 volts, 60 cycles on there. Until you start putting a load on the secondary winding, the primary winding all by itself, because of its inductive reactance, it's got some number of Henrys of inductance. You multiply that by 2 pi FL. In other words, 60 hertz is the F, 2 pi is a constant, inductance in Henry's, you multiply that out, and you may find out the primary of your transformer acts like half an ohm to your ohm meter, and it might act like 5,000 ohms at 60 hertz. That's the exact same piece of wire with the magic of being wound on that iron core, and you've got it. So if it works at 60 hertz, and you don't need the iron anymore when you do it at 146 megacycles, and you make that loop antenna, but you've got the concept. And you absorbed that one very fast, Glenn. You're a fast learner. N2ZEA, K2LAW in the TechNet.
K6DPZ, one fast comment.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Okay, stand by, Mike. We got Hal and Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Hal.
Okay, most base station antennas, vertical antennas, are shunt fed. The reason for this is for static discharge or lightning instead of the surge going down the coax. When you have a shunt fed antenna, the surge will go right to the ground. It's more of a safety thing. But at RF frequencies, it prevents a higher intensity to drive the antenna. Go ahead.
Understand, Hal. Glenn, let's wait for the beep, and you've got it, Glenn.
KC2QIQ. Good evening, Vic. Yes, the comment that I had was about some of these antennas, that many of them really aren't designed for transmitting. They really are just receive. I think the typical 2-meter full wavelength loop is somewhere has about around a 2-foot or a little bit more than 2-foot diameter, and that's much larger than the these loops that are being used on HTs for directional finding. So I don't think that they're really set up for transmitting, but I agree with everything else that you guys are mentioning, but just the thing to point out that if you're using these little directional finding loops that are pre-manufactured by a lot of these people and other manufacturers that I've seen out there, you may not want to transmit on them. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Again, if you guys are hearing things on the input when you go to the reverse mode of your transceiver and you listen to 146.25, whatever you hear, how strong it is, and where you're located, please report it at that time. Tell us what time you've heard it, where you're located, and report it to RFI at LIMARC.org. Glenn, when it comes to these small loops that go onto a handy talkie, and it's intended for direction finding for reception, but a handy talkie rarely runs any more than 5 watts, I think almost any of those small loops that are used for direction finding would not have any grief with the 5 watts coming out of a handy talkie. That's my belief. You may have a different opinion on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
The ones that I've seen, Dick, typically have a really rod impedance. As a matter of fact, the ones I've seen are like less than a foot in diameter. And as I said, I've put them on like antenna. I have like an MFJ antenna analyzer and looked at it, and the thing is just has no match anywhere near 2 meters. So I think I'm not exactly sure. Some of them even are split loops. I've seen those where it kind of like hooks out one end and it has a gap at the between the end. So there's a lot of different of these designs, but I think most of them are really. And then there's another one that has a capacitor coupling. Network underneath the bottom, so you kind of tune the loop into a high Q circuit, which there again may not be a good idea for transmitting. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, Glenn number one, N2ZEA. You're hearing some slight differences of opinion between Glenn number two and I, KC2QIQ. Glenn is a little bit suspicious as to whether or not many of the available ones have a good impedance, and there's ways of correcting that, and whether or not they could tolerate the 5 watts out of the handy talkie. I think they can. Glenn is worried about that. I do know that if transmitting power into an antenna is going to create damage, about the only way it can be done at the 5 watt level is by extra heating to take place. So if you have any doubt along these lines, you can always run the experiment of transmit briefly, by squeezing the push the talk button on your handy talkie, do it briefly, release, and touch the antenna. If everything's running ice cold, then you could run it for a longer period of time. That's true of almost any antenna. antenna were you worried about its efficiency. Put a known amount of power into it for a known amount of time, turn up the power, go over and touch things, because the only way an antenna can be inefficient is to either have an extremely high standing wave ratio and reflect all the power back to the transmitter, or to turn it into heat. The nice thing about a handy talkie is that, with rare exception, it's an extremely rugged piece of electronics. You can transmit that signal from a handy talkie into a dead short, an open circuit, or anything in between, and 99% of the time it's going to survive and self-protect. They're a very rugged piece of electronics when it comes to huge impedance mismatches, obvious by the fact that there are times when that rubber duck is laying against your body, it's wrapped into your fist or whatever, and you know you're disturbing the impedance like crazy of that antenna when you do that temporarily, and the handy talkie just laughs at you and keeps right on going. So I'm not as worried as Glenn is, but Glenn is giving us a caution, and so I guess you got to be a little bit careful. But another good area to experiment with a small loop-like antennas, direction finding, that's another whole area that can be a lot of fun with fox hunting, among other places. And 2ZEA, K2RIW in the TechNet, go right ahead, Glenn, number one.
I'll take also one more comment to add to that.
Go right ahead, Glenn, number two.
Basically, the point I was getting to, Dick, isn't so much about damaging the HT. The point I was kind of making is that doing a lot of fox hunting myself, we'll use an antenna like that in what we call the walk-in. In other words, generally you have a Doppler on your car. You get close to where you suspect your target is, and now you're going to be out on foot. So now you've got your HT and you've got your little loop antenna on the outside edge, and you're walking close to the target. You're using the null side of the antenna, and it walks you right into where the basically where the transmitter is. So it's really a reception device. Now, transmitting, I mean, the couple of screws on the top of the HT, you can put your whip right back on again. So, I mean, if you need to transmit, the antenna that comes usually with the HT works relatively well. You put these other ones on, you start transmitting, and I'm not sure that the performance is really just going to be any good at all. And it's also going to have that side null and notch, which just by walking around is going to drive you in and out of the repeater. So I'm just saying, in general, it's just not really made for transmitting. After you're done hunting down with your loop antenna, just screw the regular standard whip back on. That was kind of the direction I was going, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
K6DPZ, where the company? Okay, Glenn. I've got some further comment on what Glenn said, but Hal wants to say something. Go ahead, Hal.
Dick, I've seen many HTs come in with low and output transistors because somebody tried to use a mismatch on the antenna system. So they are fragile, and you will take out the output devices. They're not that well protected for over dissipation.
I agree with what you're saying, Hal, because when somebody creates a failure on a handy talkie, and maybe it occurs 0.05% of the time, those are the ones that you see. By the same token, if I worked in the emergency room of a hospital, I would say everybody has got the flu. Well, I'm only seeing the people who have got the flu. And the other 99% of the population doesn't have the flu. Lots and lots of people do terrible things with handy talkies and they survive. You only see the ones that have failed. That's an opinion. And you might be right, but my experience with handy talkies, I've transmitted into them lots and lots of times where I forgot to connect the antenna. It's into a pure open circuit or a short circuit because I've got some error in the cable. I've never blown the final. So maybe I'm a lucky guy. And what Glenn said, he wouldn't recommend transmitting into the antenna. I don't think anything bad will happen. And that antenna pattern you get out of the cardioid, you do have a sharp null, but only in one very narrow direction. And the chances of you having that narrow direction toward the repeater and the repeater doesn't hear you is very slim, and you just rotate your body or the handy talkie a little bit, and you're away from that. So transmitting into a direction-finding antenna with the handy talkie, I think there is no problem. Glenn would not want to do it. He thinks there is a problem. We have a slight difference of opinion on that one. Maybe neither one of us is right. Maybe the answer is somewhere between. And maybe this is one of the areas you're going to investigate, Glenn, if you want to. N2ZEA, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick,
transmit, but I'm just curious about that that zero impedance thing. Thank you again.
Very fine, Glenn. And as you find out more, please come back and tell us what you discover, because we all like to share the information as to what we discover, as to what works and what doesn't work and why. Once again, if you're hearing things that you think shouldn't be there, please go to the reverse mode, and whatever you hear, tell us the signal strength, the direction of arrival, where you're located, and what time. And give that report to RFI@Limoc.org, and the person who gives the highest quality report the most number of times is a great big prize that Rich K2KND is going to present to you. So you'll possibly get a free ticket for you and your lady friend to a fine restaurant. I'm kidding a little bit. Okay, Joe is the next guy with a question. KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Joe, what would you like to talk about tonight? K2RIW and the TechNet.
Mathematical function where under ordinary circumstances when you mix
get to what's called the sum and difference frequency. Just to give you an example, if the radio signal coming in was 100 megahertz, and if I mix that in a mixer with a local oscillator of 101 megacycles, RF is 100, local oscillator is 101. Every mixer under that requirement, under that situation, will give you sum and difference. The sum is 102, and the difference is 99. So in that example, you're putting in 100, and the two signals you get out of the IF port will be 99 and 102 simultaneously. Did I do that right? I think I did. With an image phasing mixer, image filtering mixer, image hybrid mixer, when you set it up correctly, you can select the 102 or the 99, and everything else will be rejected. You can select one or the other, high side or low side. Which, in the normal receiver, whichever one you desire, if you desired the 99, then from your point of view, the other signal, the 102, is called an image. Just like a signal and noise or signal and clutter, it depends on what you consider valuable and what you consider not valuable. But it's just a set of words, if you know what I mean. But every mixer will always give you two output frequencies. And with an image phasing mixer, you can electronically select which one you want, and the undesired one can easily be rejected by 20 dB and beyond when you use one of those circuits correctly. Very fancy circuit, very nice thing to know about. And if you Google those words, image phasing mixer, guarantee you'll get quite a few responses, and guarantee there's some pretty nice articles telling you how to do it. And it's a little bit close to what happens with a balanced amplifier. A balanced amplifier uses some of those characteristics. Balanced amplifier is where you've got a 90-degree hybrid in front of a pair of amplifiers, and it gives you all kinds of advantages. Most of the solid-state amplifiers we use are balanced amplifiers, not a simple amplifier. Back to you, John. KC2WGB. This is Larry W. on the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Just left a little time there for the people in the outer reach areas. All right, very good, Dick. By the way, are those used only in the better class, or is it just used in special equipment? That was another question he had alluded to.
Because a image phasing mixer requires two separate mixers, requires two separate local oscillator sources, the same local oscillator frequency, but you've got to divide it into two separate signals 90 degrees apart. The RF has to divide it into two separate signals 90 degrees apart. It requires twice as much or three times as much hardware in the mixer section of the receiver. Therefore, it might appear with modern-day integrated circuits, it might appear in inexpensive equipment, but in the past, it was only used on expensive equipment. It tended to be military equipment, because of all the extra requirements, and also not very many people understand the philosophy and the theory of operation, so they weren't smart enough to know to request it. There's many a time when an image phasing mixer is required, but the person doesn't know that such a circuit exists, therefore he doesn't know to request it and doesn't know to seek it, if you know what I mean. He's in the first state of knowledge. He doesn't know what he doesn't know, which, by the way, is most of us most of the time. So I've seen them in some inexpensive circuits sometimes. I will admit most of the time I've seen it on fairly sophisticated military hardware. KC2WGB, K2RIW and the TechNet.